We're all working so hard to save up as much money as we can, but how are we actually protecting that money from hackers and people who are looking to steal it? If you're going to listen to one episode this year, this is the one that you need to hear. You'll walk away with actionable tips on what you can do to protect all of your savings accounts and also learn a little bit about the cybersecurity rabbit hole. Let's go.
Welcome to Fire Drill Podcast, where side hustles, savings, and creativity lead to financial independence. With your hosts, Gwen from Fiery Millennials and Jay from Millennial Boss.
Welcome to another episode of Fire Drill Podcast. Today's guest is David, and David is a security subject matter expert on any and all things security. Okay, that's a lie. There's a few small things that he's really good at. So welcome, David, to the show.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me.
And of course, we have our awesome co-host, Jay. What up, Jay?
Hello. So David, I went down a rabbit hole of cybersecurity and privacy best practices after listening to one of my favorite podcasts, Reply All.
Yes.
And they had an episode called The Snapchat Thief, where one of their friends had her Snapchat hacked into by this ring of bandit hackers. And it wasn't just about how her Snapchat got hacked. It's how your entire life can be exposed online and people can do all these horrible things like blackmail you and take your money and all these things. So it made me a little more paranoid and more interested in privacy. And I think this is more than just a paranoia. It's especially relevant to our FIRE community group because we are a group of people that we save a lot of money, more than the average person, and we are very open about sharing that online in some ways. So we'd love to bring you in to tell us, what do we need to know to be safe and keep our financial accounts safe?
Yeah, and I too heard the same Reply All podcast. I think it was great and very scary. But yeah, and I think I'm someone who's working on the FI part of FIRE and spend a lot of time reading a lot of blogs and following a lot of folks in the FIRE community. And I've definitely had concerns before thinking about, man, some people are very public about how much money they have, what banks they use, what online services they use.
A lot of me.
Yeah, you, everyone else. I mean, we all do it to some degree. But like you said, when people are saving more than the average person, and especially folks that are into Bitcoin and other things that are very easy to transfer and very hard to get back, then yeah, I definitely have thought a little bit about how that community might be particularly vulnerable to people that want to do bad things and take money.
So where do we even start with all this? Do you think we should start with the threat model?
Yeah, I think that's pretty essential to this. Is when you talk to people online about online security, some people say you've got really nothing to worry about. Other people say throw away all your phones, never use unencrypted internet connections, do everything via Tor, only talk to people on Signal and other things like that. But I think the most important thing is to understand what your threat model is. If you have a lot of money in online accounts, if you're a very public person, then you may have to take different steps to secure your accounts and secure yourself online compared to someone that doesn't do those things. And even more so if you're a politician who's being targeted by some state-sponsored actor, or if you're a dissident in a foreign country, then yeah, you may have an entirely different threat model that goes even well beyond things we'll talk about today. But I think that's kind of important because there's no such thing as perfect security or perfect privacy. There's no way that you can completely protect yourself from things. You can just do as best as you can to get to the point where you've done everything you can to try to keep yourself safe.
And how do you know all this?
So actually, my background is in computer science and information security. So went to school for that. Then I worked for NASA doing computer forensics. And then I was actually a federal agent doing computer crime investigations, and then moved to the private sector doing computer security stuff. And currently I'm a security architect for a company called Oath, which includes Yahoo and AOL and Huffington Post and Tumblr and a bunch of other companies.
Wow.
We're going to have a really good conversation about Tumblr after this is over.
That's not where I was going with this. I'm thinking you are very qualified and we're excited. So, okay. You talked about threat levels, so I'm thinking that Gwen, given that she has just been syndicated on all these major publications worldwide and she shares a lot of information, she probably is at a higher threat level than maybe the average person listening. But either way, where do we start? What do you think is the first thing that we need to know that we should be doing that most people don't do?
I think the first thing really, because you kind of also have to think of it in terms of layers. You've got your individual accounts on different services. Then you've got maybe email addresses or some other means that ties those accounts together. And then you may have other things that tie your email accounts together or recovery options for those. So other email addresses or maybe a phone number. So I think the most basic thing to start with is the accounts you have on different services. And for each of those accounts, doing two things. One, using a unique password for that service, a unique and difficult to guess password. And two, taking advantage of whatever specific security options are given by that, whatever that service is. Do they offer the ability to put a second factor authentication on the account? Do they give you the ability to do some sort of app-based authentication on your phone or something else? That's all going to depend differently for different services. But I think those are kind of the two baseline things that you'd want to do for each of these different online accounts. And a lot of it revolves around passwords and password management. So the other part of that, I'd say, is have a password manager, use a password manager, because you're never going to be able to remember unique passwords to every website and online service you have to use.
And by password manager, you mean like KeePass or 1Password?
Yeah, so KeePass, 1Pass, and LastPass, I'd say, are all pretty well known and regarded. Other things like Dashlane as well. I'd say probably the easiest ones for the average person to use would be 1Password and LastPass, whereas KeePass gives you some ability to just only store passwords on your local machine. So some people that are a little more paranoid would prefer that. But I'd say any one of those services with a good, strong master password, because again, your account's only going to be as strong as whatever that master password is to get into your password manager. That's going to be kind of key to keeping everything straight when it comes to your passwords.
So do you recommend downloading these instead of Keychain that comes with Mac and uses the iCloud, or Chrome browser password savings? These are on top of that or instead of?
Those other options have definitely gotten better as the years have gone on. I definitely remember a time when you'd store passwords and thing in some browsers like Firefox and such. And the ways those were implemented, it was very easy if a bad guy got on your machine or your machine got infected with something for it to pull all your passwords out. Those have definitely gotten better. But I would still, especially for the ability to use them across different operating systems and across different browsers and different types of devices, things like 1Password and LastPass are going to give you more flexibility for that.
And are they free, or how much do they cost?
Yeah, so I think both offer free options that are going to be good enough for most people. I think they both offer paid tiers, which offer like more device support or may offer other services, but they both offer free options. And I think for most people, the free options would work just fine.
And what do you recommend for actual password making? What I heard is the new trend is to string random words that don't make sense together.
Especially if you have to remember a password, you're much better off doing passphrases rather than a password, just because it's a lot easier to be able to remember multiple words put together, especially if you do some changes in capitalization or add some numbers in there and things like that. But to be honest, if you're using a password manager, in most cases, you don't even have to worry about it. With these password managers, they have built-in functionality where you pick whatever the parameters are. You're on a site that says your password could be no more than 20 characters. You pop in that limit into the password manager, say, generate password. It generates a brand new password for you, and you never even have to come up with it in your head. So in a perfect world, that's what you do for generating your passwords. There may be some places where you need to put in a password somewhere else that you can't get to the password manager. It may differ a little bit, but in general, your best bet is to do it through the password manager itself.
And this may be obvious, but if you ever bought something from a company that was included in a breach, you should probably never use that password again. And you probably shouldn't be using passwords multiple times anyways, right?
Yeah, that's part of it too, is when a breach comes out and it becomes public, then at that point, you know that that password has been compromised. But in the cases of a lot of breaches in the past, the company may not have known about it for any amount of time beforehand, and bad guys may have had those passwords for months or years and been able to use them before anyone knew about it publicly. So because of that, you can't really rely on just waiting until it comes out publicly to do something about it. You're much better off just never reusing passwords in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, that's great. I have like all of my passwords that need to be changed.
I know. I'm sure everyone listening is in the same boat. So there's this website, Have I Been PWNED, where you can see if you are involved in a breach.
Yes.
I've always been afraid to use a website like that because I feel like it just alerts people to me. Do you recommend using something like that?
First of all, the guy that runs it, Troy Hunt, is a really fantastic guy in the security community. And he takes a bunch of data breaches and dumps that come out and then has a searchable database where you can put in your email address and see whether or not it has shown up in dumps before. But because he doesn't store the password, he's not giving out the password or anything like that. There's no real risk to just putting in your own email address on there and seeing, has it shown up in a dump? And what you can do also through the site is subscribe so that if your email address shows up in future dumps, then you'll get a notification about it. There's really no risk to doing that just because all it's asking for is what is your email address. And then you're just getting notifications later on. But yeah, it's a great site and it's really eye-opening if you have an email account you've used for a long time on a lot of different services to plug it in there and see just how many different places it's shown up in public in the past.
So let's talk about email. When I was first getting my Gmail, someone recommended firstname.lastname@gmail.com because that's professional and that should be on your resume. Do you have email addresses with your name? What kind of privacy and security steps do you take when you give out your email address or use email?
That's also a good question and one of those things that depends on whatever your threat model happens to be. Email, I kind of see when we're talking about the different layers of security, we've moved up from the online accounts themselves, and email is usually what ties all those accounts together. You sign up for a website, you're signing up with it with an email address. So protecting the email account is that much more important because it is the means to get into all those other associated accounts. In a perfect world, for the most security you could possibly have, you would ideally have a different email address that you would use for online sites, maybe even multiple emails from multiple sites that you wouldn't use to talk to people and you wouldn't use to communicate. You wouldn't give it out. It would help keep it from being out there. I would say the vast majority of us don't do that because that is quite an extra step to be juggling multiple emails for that kind of thing. But when it comes to the security of your email account, securing it is pretty similar when it comes to those other accounts. You want to have a unique password. You're not using it elsewhere. You want to use whatever the security features are offered by your email provider. Every major email provider at this point offers second-factor authentication with your phone, which at the very least you should do. Many of them also offer app-based security. So Yahoo offers Yahoo Account Key. Google allows the ability to push sign-in notifications to the Google app. I know Microsoft offers that as well. And that's going to be even better for the reasons that Jay was hinting at before as far as SIM swapping and getting control of people's phones. Much better to do an app-based one rather than one associated with your phone number. But yeah, in general, securing an email is going to be very similar to securing those other accounts, just with the added caveat that if someone gets into the email, it's probably going to be a lot harder to fix the damage than it is if someone gets into any one account.
And using different emails, if you do mail forwarding, it's not that hard. I think in Google, it's pretty easy to set up mail forwarding.
Yeah, you definitely can. I think the harder part is, I think most people have not, perhaps up until now, set up their accounts in a way with the intention of having multiple emails. So going back and kind of unraveling all the different services that you may use with one email address and then moving them to another may be a bit of a challenge or at least a long weekend of work. But at the same time, again, depending on your threat model and how public you are and how much you have to lose, then doing that kind of work may be worth it.
Yeah, my Yahoo, it's pretty great. Every time that I go to log into it on the browser, it makes me click yes on my phone, which I think is awesome.
Yeah, so that kind of stuff.
Kind of a pain, but huge, but worth it.
Yeah, and I think that kind of stuff is definitely the app-based login stuff. The one-time passwords and things like that are a step above SMS messages when it comes to keeping things safe.
So when I went down my rabbit hole, I started listening to the Privacy, Security, and OSINT podcast. And on that podcast, the guy is a former FBI investigator. and now works in the private sphere. And he always talks about using Proton Mail and how Proton Mail is better than Gmail for security reasons. And I don't really understand why. Do you use any other mail providers? And should we be doing that?
I've tried a lot of different mail providers. I think the ways in which someone may consider something like Proton Mail more secure are it has built-in end-to-end encryption for if you are sending a message to another Proton Mail user, which is useful if you need to put something sensitive into an email that you're sending back and forth. I don't know necessarily that in general the service itself is more secure. To be frank, the security team at Google and the security team at Yahoo, security team at any of these really large tech companies, really well staffed, really well backed, and a lot of really smart people trying to keep people safe. So because of that, I have a lot of confidence in those services and their general security and the kind of work that's being done on them. But I think, again, like in that case, also Proton Mail is hosted outside of the United States. So some people feel more secure having their email in a jurisdiction that law enforcement can't get to from the United States. So again, it's one of those things where you can definitely look at the general pros and cons of the security features offered by one service versus another, but I wouldn't necessarily say that Proton Mail is more secure than your Gmail or Yahoo or something else.
Got it. Okay, so now let's talk about SIM hacking. The topic that I'm so fascinated by and terrified by.
Yes.
Can you help everyone understand what even is SIM hacking?
SIM hacking, or it's also known as SIM swapping, is what is done. So it's particularly a problem when it comes to emails, to email accounts, financial accounts, Bitcoin accounts has been a big problem where a fraudster calls up someone first. You want to get into Gwen's account. Someone knows Gwen's phone number by some means. Either they've looked it up online using open source research, or it's been given out, or it showed up in a data breach somewhere, but they have her phone number. And using any of those same tools or just general knowledge, they know what the provider is. That's public information for phone numbers, what provider it's associated with. It's not always accurate because people port their numbers and move around, but not too hard, generally speaking, to find out what their carrier is. Then someone calls up.
Or you can look at my blog.
Yeah, or and other people have some sort of partnership deal or something where they're touting their some of the smaller MVNOs and things like that. But anyways, the bad guy calls up the carrier and says, hey, my name's Gwen. Either I just lost my phone and got a new one and I need to move my SIM over, or I bought a new phone and it uses a different SIM size than my old one, so I need a new SIM moved over for that. But through one mean or another, are able to socially engineer the carrier into sending a new SIM and activating a new SIM for that same phone number, and also deactivating the old one, in which case all the different online accounts that are secured using SMS or phone calls to that phone number are now routing to the bad guy. And the poor person who was targeted and then this just has a phone that says no SIM detected or emergency calls only, and they're not sure what's going on while someone's rifling through their accounts. And yeah, that's kind of scary.
What happens if you have like the eSIM? How does that help prevent that? Or does it?
I'm going to be perfectly honest. I'm not sure whether that helps or hurts the situation. The fact that sometimes this is done in person at a store. So the fact that I don't necessarily know that the in-person at a store would change one way or another, whether they're handing them a physical SIM or just activating the eSIM, because I'm assuming the other SIM can be deactivated or swapped just as well. So yeah, to be perfectly honest, I don't know all the details of how that helps or hurts the situation.
Yeah, because when I got my new phone, it has an eSIM in it. It doesn't even have a chip SIM in it at all.
Gwen, stop telling us all the details. We're all just going to use it against you to hack into your account. And where do you live? What's your number? Like, seriously.
Never going to share anything. This is why I've moved 10 times in 7 years.
How come the phone provider will make that move? Like, don't you need to have your SSN too? Or they're doing it without even verifying other things about the person?
In a lot of cases, they are verifying other things about the person. Because ultimately, yeah, the phone company has no interest in handing over your account to a bad guy, because that's just causing trouble for them and obviously causing trouble for you as a customer. But there have definitely been documented cases where the information used to verify an account is all information that someone can get with a background check, or even just get through some of these public information, open source research systems for searching for demographic information and past addresses used and phone numbers and emails associated with a person. So using that information, they potentially can just answer the right questions and get into the account. The way to try and prevent this from happening is phone providers will allow you, all the major ones at least, will allow you to put a PIN on your account, which is just a PIN like you have on debit card or something else, but some sort of a numeric code or passphrase or something else that you have to give when you call up the company and want to make changes on your account. And that, assuming that the company abides by that and actually asks for that and won't make any changes without it, that would, in theory, help prevent someone from just being able to look up some information about you and call about it.
So you hope your company is the dude and they abide.
Yes.
So I think this is kind of the situation where if you have two people running from a bear, you just have to be faster than the person next to you. In this situation, basically, if someone gets your phone number, and there are a lot of leaked places where you can see personal details about people online that can be used to pass the verification questions or whatever the provider has, they basically can get into your account. So you have to make yourself harder, or it takes longer, like make yourself a less good target, I guess. So what are some ways that you could do that?
First of all, I'd recommend everyone set a PIN on their account, just because it doesn't take a lot of effort, but at the same time, it really does. Again, assuming that customer service at your carrier abides by whatever the instructions you gave or the PIN that you gave, I think that really does help in a lot of cases from being just kind of low-hanging fruit.
Don't pick your birthday.
I wouldn't. Yeah, no, not your birthday, not your zip code, not the street you grew up on, none of those things. Some of the things you can do to make that harder is, obviously, you can have multiple phone numbers. You could use something like a Google Voice number or another virtual phone number for some services, not give that phone number out. One of the other things you can do is go through and unsubscribe from a lot of these open source background information research sites, things like Spokio and PeopleSearch and Pipple, P-I-P-L, and some of the other ones. You can go through and request that they remove your information from it, which is a bit of a pain because there are a lot of them out there. There are also third-party services that will offer to do this for you. The caveat to that being you have to give them all this information first so they can then turn around and ask other people to get rid of it. So caveat emptor on that kind of thing. But most of these services also offer just a list of all the sites that they opt out of. And you can go to each individual site and look at what their process is. And a lot of them just require you to send in a request. Some of them require a redacted image of your driver's license. Some of them require filling out a form. So different sites require different things, but at least for most of the major ones, you can request pretty easily to get your information taken off of there.
So you know how we're talking about the threat model? Is this like what normal people should do? People should actually do this. You've done it. We should do it.
Again, it is definitely extra work, and it depends on to what degree someone is concerned about the fact that maybe their past addresses, their past phone numbers, their relatives' information, who they lived with, information like that may be out there. And again, some people won't think it's particularly scary. Some people are already freaking out and looking up right now as they're listening to this. But I do think it is a good thing to do. And at least for some of the major sites, your Spokios and what have you, that make that opt-out process pretty easy, then it's not a heavy lift to be able to remove some of the easier places to go find information about you.
Yeah, and I would say current address too. I mean, you don't want people to know where you live.
Correct.
In case the wrong person is interested.
Yep, 100%.
When you said Google Voice, I have never personally used it, but a lot of people at work use it, like in normal things. They use it anytime you have to give your number out anywhere to anybody, like you just give the Google Voice number. And actually on the podcast, people had even used it for online dating. Like you never want to give your actual number to someone. You should just do this. Do you use Google Voice? Can you explain what it is for people who've never heard of it before?
So Google Voice, and there are other virtual number services online that you can sign up. Most of them are paid in some way, shape, or form. Google Voice is not, if you just want to use a Google Voice number. But it literally acts just like a regular phone number in that someone can call it. You can do calling and messaging directly through the number, either through a browser, through the mobile app, or you can have it forward to other phone numbers. So I know back when it first came out, it was particularly popular because if you have a work phone, you have a personal phone, you had maybe a landline phone at the time, you could have a single Google Voice number ring all those different services so that no matter where you are, what phone you have with you, then it would be accessible that way. But you can also use it conceivably to be able to more easily have more phone numbers and phone numbers you can use for, say, more risky things than having to sign up for a whole nother phone at an actual carrier and have an actual another physical device. A lot of people know about Google Voice, but there are also burner apps. In fact, one just called Burner, which is probably the most popular, I'd imagine, that allow you to pay a small amount of money to set up these either one-time use or long-time use phone numbers. For example, if there's some reason that you have to put a phone number out on the internet somewhere for whatever reason it happens to be, or if you have to give it online dating, something else, you need to give out your number in some way, shape, or form, but you don't yet know whether you really want to trust someone with that number, then being able to generate a new burner number, use it. If someone starts blowing it up, you can just dump it, get rid of it, and move on to a new one. Yeah, things like that are definitely useful for, you know, that interpersonal security. I don't necessarily know how that helps or hurts doing security for online accounts and such. I don't imagine you'd want to use a burner number for that. But it comes to actual like communications with people or needing to post a phone numbers publicly or semi-publicly, then using a burner app to do that or a Google Voice number for that matter definitely helps keep your personal number secure.
I did that online dating spree. I kept getting tired of these guys like randomly blowing up my phone later. And so I had an app on my phone that gave me a number and I gave it out and then it forwarded it to my number. So they didn't actually get my number, but it was like it was. And if I didn't want them to text me anymore, then I just got rid of that number and got a new one. It worked out well.
Perfect. Yeah.
So I think the conclusion of this piece of the podcast is you should not be giving your phone number out to anyone that you haven't vetted. And it's not that hard to use Google Voice and these other things. And you definitely shouldn't be giving it out online to random services.
Most of that, I think of it more from protecting yourself against harassment or just people blowing up your phone that you don't necessarily want blowing up your phone. I think when it comes to securing your accounts with your phone numbers, a couple things. One, if a service allows you not to secure your account using a phone number, instead, you guys may be familiar with YubiKeys.
And yeah.
That's a specific brand, but it's kind of also synonymous with these hardware-based second factor tokens. A YubiKey is much better than a phone number because it is a physical device you have to have on you. If you can't plug it in or sync it with your phone, then you can't get into the account. And that's going to be a lot harder for someone to be able to get access to compared to convincing a call center rep that they are you and to give them access to your SIM. So I think ideally, long term, we should move away from phone numbers for authentication because they are a public thing. There's something you share. There's something you talk to other people with. There's something that's not super hard to move from one carrier to another and one phone to another. It's kind of like social security numbers. Ideally, they never would have been made into the security code that they're used for now, since they're tended to be semi-public. Ideally, you move away from using a phone number to secure services and do some of this other stuff instead. But in the places where you do have to, because most places still use it as a recovery option for your accounts, then ideally don't have it out in so many places and have it secured as much as you can with your phone carrier.
So with the YubiKeys, can you just buy one yourself online off of Amazon or something?
You can, yeah. So you can buy it off of Amazon. You can buy it from the specific people that make them, companies like YubiKey. Also, some services will even send them to you if you sign up to use them on their service, like a financial provider or something else. There is also, like if you are truly paranoid, there's a level of Google Gmail security called Advanced Protection that requires you to have two YubiKeys for your account, and you can no longer use your phone number or another email address to recover your account. You're limited to only those hardware devices. And then if you lose them, what have you, you have to go through a very long process to be able to prove you are who you say you are and get back in. There's more and more services online, more and more email providers, more and more financial providers that allow you to use hardware-based tokens like YubiKeys to be able to prove you are who you are when you're trying to get into your account.
We just got those for the people that I supported at my last job, the YubiKeys. Nobody really went for it, to be honest, but I kind of like the idea.
Well, let's say that you're someone listening, you have $100,000 in a brokerage account with one of the big banks or whatever. Are we saying that they could buy a YubiKey, and if that financial provider offers the ability, instead of doing a phone number authentication, if they allow you to use the token, that is preferred?
Yeah, so I'd say, because it does completely depend on the institution, I'd say in order of how secure they would be, and this is somewhat arguable, I mean, there are pros and cons to all these different approaches, but if I had X financial provider, in a perfect world, they would support YubiKeys and hardware-based U2F authentication. I'd use that. If they didn't offer that, then I would hope they had some sort of a app-based authentication, like they have a mobile app on the phone that you can push a login to the same way that Google and Yahoo and other people do it. And then, if nothing else, then hopefully they would offer the phone-based SMS two-factor authentication. And then if they don't offer any of those things, I frankly would not use that financial institution because I would not want to trust $100,000 to a password just because passwords get phished. If someone's got malware on their computer, they may not even know that their password is getting grabbed by something. So ideally, you would have one of those higher security offerings from whatever your financial institution happened to be.
Also, by the way, I did not realize how to spell YubiKey. It's not UB. It's with a Y. YUBI. Did not know that.
It is with a Y. And to be clear, they're a brand. If they were not the first in the space, they are the best known in the space. But Google now offers their own, they call it Titan Security Keys, I believe, which are not made by Google, but they're made by another manufacturer and then badged by Google, and Google stands by them. So there are other companies that make them. It just, it's kind of like pick your Kleenex and tissues or something else where a particular brand has kind of become synonymous with the device itself.
Got it. It's not easy to figure out which financial companies use them, though, or would let you use them. Do you know?
I frankly do not know off the top of my head. I do know that some financial companies offer the app-based authentication stuff and or the SMS stuff, which again is not great, but is certainly better than just the password.
Got it. Okay. Coming soon, probably, to a financial provider near you. All right. Well, while we're talking about protecting your financial accounts specifically, we talked about what email address you use, passwords. We talked about maybe using hardware, being careful what phone number you use. Is there anything else that you personally do for all of your FI accounts that you think other people should?
I think another just general good practice, if it's offered, is a lot of financial institutions, when it comes to credit cards and debit cards, offer the ability to use virtual numbers or one-time numbers as opposed to using the same credit card number everywhere. You can use a different one for different merchants. That's useful. And similarly, when you use things like Apple Pay that obscure the actual credit card number from whatever the merchant is, then those help prevent someone getting a hold of your credit card number and then turning around and using it. It's obviously not the same thing as a brokerage account or something of that nature, but when it comes to just your day-to-day, how you spend money, then using those services definitely helps.
So basically, if I want to buy something from a sketchy site that I saw on Facebook, I can use a one-time credit card or debit card or use Apple Pay, and that's way better than giving them my actual credit card number.
It will definitely be way better. You have to consider that they're also getting what your billing address is or any other stuff you have to put in there. So still think twice. It's definitely not a perfect solution to buying something that you're not really sure about, but it's definitely much less likely to lead to the breach of your credit card number and a bunch of unauthorized charges that you weren't intending.
Got it. Yeah, the podcast I listen to, they recommend privacy.com. I think they have some sort of relationship with them. But someone told me that like Bank of America and some of the banks, they provide the same service, like virtual debit cards or virtual credit cards or something.
Yep.
Wow, that's literally the nicest thing I've heard anybody say about Bank of America in a long time.
Nice. Anything else regarding credit card or debit cards that we need to know?
We could talk about this stuff for the rest of the day when it comes to all the different security stuff, because some people are worried about RFID things, and we could talk about skimming of cards and things like that. But again, I think probably the most important things to do are just the things that everyone should do in terms of securing those accounts, securing the means to get into those accounts or recover access to those accounts. And ideally, in a perfect world, yeah, using some of those services either through the credit card company or through a third-party payment company like Apple Pay or things like that that help keep your credit card number from getting out there when you're making purchases.
Got it. So you mentioned billing address, and this is something that I've been thinking about. Should we have like a P.O. box? Should we be using our actual billing address every time we have to enter our address in?
I don't. Frankly, I don't know whether credit card issuers allow you to use a P.O. box as a billing address. I just don't know. I do think that, for example, a long time ago, I was registering a website for the first time, and it was back when things like GDPR wasn't out there yet, so privacy protection was not nearly as common. So I definitely, at that point, I ended up registering a P.O. box so that my personal address would not show up associated with the Whois information for that website. So I do think potentially having a P.O. box or a mail forwarding address somewhere can potentially be useful if you have to have your address in some public places. But I don't know specifically to billing information whether or not you can do that.
Right. Yeah. And I think it probably goes back to what you're saying with threat model. So if you're someone that you are in the unfortunate situation of domestic violence and you're trying to set up your new life somewhere, you need to be extra careful, like of how you do your address and all these things. And I'm assuming even things like, you know, the utilities, like making sure that you don't put your actual address with utility companies is probably ways around that. But if you're a regular person, it may not be as important.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, speaking to that, I mean, part of the threat model is what you're trying to protect or what you think is potentially at risk. So if it is a threat or a risk of bodily harm for one reason or another, the domestic violence situation, or because of activism in a country that represses that sort of free speech or what have you, then yeah, your threat model is not only going to be slightly different or vastly different, but also the kinds of things you're going to be trying to protect are potentially going to be slightly or more different, just in terms of your location may matter a lot more in that case compared to someone that's trying to keep people out of their bank account.
Right. In the case of your address and like your phone number and things like that, the podcast suggested using the proactive approach of disinformation, where you can submit an alias name at your address. Like, let's say like it's too late. You bought your house and your address is everywhere and you don't want it to be anymore. You could sign up for like a cruise line or sign up for like a wedding registry, because those places are very likely to sell your data to third parties. And you could put someone else's name with your address and just make it more confusing who lives there. Do you ever do any disinformation techniques? And do you think a regular person who doesn't have an increased threat risk should do that?
I am not as familiar with those sorts of more proactive approaches to putting that information out there. I don't think I'm really in a position to speak about it. It does strike me as something that is probably not something every person out there should probably need to take the time to do in terms of putting fake information out there. But I'm sure there are some people for whom that would actually be useful. I'm just not as familiar with the ways of going about it or how effective it is or isn't.
Right. Yeah, it said you can also buy property in a trust too, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, and some of this stuff as far as business mail addresses and things like that, or trusts and what have you, that's also another area I'm not as familiar with, but obviously there are privacy and business reasons why people may want to use those, and some of it may have to do with keeping their information secure, keeping their assets safe.
Or, you know, if you won the lottery, Never sign it under your own name. Get a lawyer, get a trust, and then you can sign for it.
That sounds like a good plan.
So what about internet browsing security? Do you use a VPN, and would you use it if you're at Starbucks trying to use the Wi-Fi or on your home internet? Tell me more.
Yeah, I think it's also another, all roads lead back to threat models. Your example about being in a Starbucks on an open Wi-Fi somewhere, I would 100% recommend that people use a VPN service if they are on any sort of public, unencrypted, unsecure Wi-Fi, just because you want to make sure that whatever you're doing on there is safe, that people can't snoop in on the traffic, can't inject things into the traffic and make you visit things you didn't intend to, things like that. Whereas if you're at home and you're just looking up things online, you're on your own home internet, and hopefully your internet is secured, has a password, what have you, and not anyone can just log into it and look at what you're doing. In that case, it's a slightly different threat model. So are you concerned that your ISP may see what you're doing just because of whatever you're looking up or whatever sorts of communities you're a part of or what have you? Then maybe in that case, you want to have a VPN for what you're doing because that will obscure where you're going and what you're looking at. Or you may not care. Maybe ultimately, the only things you're really worried about are the keeping people out of accounts or keeping your computer safe or things like that, in which case maybe you only really need to worry about a VPN when you're in some of those more dangerous environments.
Do you personally use one?
Yeah, so I definitely use in the public Wi-Fi kind of situation, 100%. I always do and would recommend that other people do.
What is one? Some people don't even understand how they even get one.
I'm trying to think. Just the other day, I saw that there are a lot of best of lists as far as the best VPN services. I guess some of the better known ones, I'd say, and I'm not personally endorsing any of these, but there are things like NordVPN and ExpressVPN, things like TunnelBear and Private Internet Access. And there's quite a few of them out there. And there's a lot of websites that go through the pros and cons of some of them are more reliable, some of them are more secure, but maybe a little bit slower, or offer different countries you can come out of or things like that. And the basic idea with a VPN is just you're taking your internet traffic, putting it in this kind of encrypted connection, and then bouncing that connection through whatever this service is. So if you want your connection to be coming out of Norway, your connection can come out of Norway. If you want it coming out of Canada, it can come out of Canada. Or if you just want it to come out of somewhere geographically close to where you are, but just not associated with you, you can do that as well. And in the meantime, that connection is encrypted between you and the provider. And because of that, someone on your local network can't snoop and see what you're doing or mess around with your internet traffic.
Gwen, do you use anything like that, VPN or private browsers?
Yeah, I have a VPN. It's probably not the best one. And honestly, I only use it for one reason, and that's to watch Cardinals baseball when I'm within the MLB blackout area. So I use basically an IP hider is what it is. It's not really a VPN, but it makes it look like I'm coming in from Russia or something. Then I can watch my Cardinals baseball. But for everyday average use, no, I do not. And I probably should.
And the other thing to clarify is the difference between like VPNs and private browsing. So most people probably know whatever their browser is that they can choose some sort of a private browsing mode on there. And that, generally speaking, just means it doesn't keep your session. It doesn't log whatever site you're visiting into the history on the computer. So the next person coming on there wouldn't have any idea that it was you who was on there. That's useful, obviously, for shared computers. It's useful for a lot of different reasons. But the caveat there is it's still going across your network. So your ISP still sees whatever you're doing in a private internet tab. Anyone on the local network would still see whatever you're doing in a private internet browser tab. So just to be clear that if you truly want to be anonymous in whatever you're doing, you would want to do a couple of these things. You'd probably want both a private browser tab and you'd want a VPN. So both the browser is not going back to you and the internet connection is not going back to you.
Yeah. Before, when I was hearing about all these things, I didn't think they were for me because it sounded like, why would I need to be using a private browser? All these things. But then I started using the Starbucks in Mountain View to buy things online. And within 3 seconds, someone had got my credit card. So I need to be like a lot more aware and just not be lazy and put time towards this, because in our FIRE community, like, or the financial independence community, we have a lot to lose from a financial perspective with this stuff.
Yep. I would agree.
Yeah. So I think that was most of the topics that we wanted to cover today. This community, like the FI community, has a lot of overlap with others like van living and with sailboats and like entrepreneurs and selling things online. But there's a certain subset that's also interested in like maybe survivalism or like, what's the word, survivalist? I know, Gwen, we talked about that on a Facebook Live one time. David, do you have any thoughts on that or like comments or things that you do regarding that?
I don't particularly consider myself to be part of the community. I mean, I guess I think of it only as far as part of the reason why you're doing all these things and keeping things secure is because the layers of security help you if financial provider X has a problem or your account gets compromised in one place. It doesn't cascade and ruin your life across everything. I think outside of that, I don't really have a lot of interaction with that community.
Well, we'll link to our Facebook Live, but this has been a requested topic, actually. People email us and say that we should bring on someone to discuss this because there is such overlap. So we'll have to think about that for the future. All right. Well, are there any other topics, David, regarding security that are must-knows for anyone?
I do want to just go back to what we were talking about in the beginning, that this is not intended to say everyone should go throw out their phone or go register 10 phones in their name, go smash up their laptop, go move somewhere and not tell anyone where they moved. The idea for this is there are some simple steps as far as passwords in a password manager, securing your phone account with a PIN, using whatever are the top tier security offerings that your online services offer. Basic steps like that, and then things like being careful about clicking on links and emails, not getting phished. Again, we could talk about that stuff forever, but just taking some of those basic steps goes a long way to making sure that you're not the low-hanging fruit for an online attacker that in a lot of cases may not even be particularly looking just for you. Maybe again, in this community, they're big fish enough that people would be going after them directly, but a lot of online fraud is just where someone happens to get in, where a breached password works with someone's account on a different service, or they used a very common password that is easy to crack and easy to guess. Just taking some of those basic computer hygiene and online account hygiene steps, I think, can go a long way to making sure that you're not easy, low-hanging fruit for someone that's just looking to make a buck online.
So if we've inspired you to do anything in this episode, change your passwords. Go back through your top financial accounts and use a password manager or make them difficult. It will only take you 20 minutes for the top five, wherever your money is. Just do that.
Yep. And don't use the same password in multiple places.
Nope. So David, this is the first time that we haven't talked about anyone's personal journey with FIRE. And now I feel kind of bad asking you about it. Not only the fact that we waited till like the end, but also maybe you don't want to share this information about yourself because you're like so secure and private. So I want to give you an opportunity. Tell everyone with what you're comfortable sharing. Who is David?
I came to the FIRE community through, of all people, surprise, surprise, Mr. Money Mustache, and just reading his online stuff. But I came to it pretty late. I mean, I want to say I only really was cognizant of it within the past year and a half. But I have definitely been a saver for a long time, spent a lot of time thanks to friends that had turned me on to Dave Ramsey before paying off a lot of debt. And accordingly, definitely feel at home in the FIRE community. I definitely myself plan to for more of the FI part. I really enjoy the work I do. Don't have any plans to retire anytime in the near future. But at the same time, I definitely like the idea of having the ability to be financially independent and choose to do the kind of work you do because you want to, or choose not to work because you want to. And yeah, I'm working my way through that.
Do you have a vision of when you're FI or financially independent, what that will look or feel like?
I think what it'll feel like is just the fact that, I mean, I love the company I work for. I love the work I do, but you never know what's going to happen to any sort of company in the future or what the future holds in terms of the economy as a whole or anything else. For me, it's just mostly the forward to it, or what I'm looking forward to about it is just the freedom, the ability to be able to push back if there is anything that changes about my job in a way that I don't necessarily want to continue doing it. Also, just having the flexibility to be able to choose where I want to be geographically, regardless of a job. To be honest, I don't have any real specific plans in that area, other than I'm just making sure to live below my means and be prepared for whatever the future may hold.
It feels like security.
I'm trying.
Yep. I'm on the same page because I love my job. And to me, it's like, well, why wouldn't I save? I have no plans to leave it. It's really giving me a lot. This is something I can see myself doing when we hit our fine number. But why wouldn't I want to have a lot of money saved so that I can always have options? No brainer.
Yeah. And when you had talked before about being in a position to be able to help family and the folks around you and such, that definitely resonates with me. And I want to be in a position where it's not just purely being done on my account, but hopefully puts me in a position to better help people around me as well.
Love that. All right. Well, Gwen, I think it's time for the final two. I'll let you do the honor.
So, David, if people want to get a hold of you and ask you more security questions, how can they do so?
Yeah. So the easiest way I'd say is I'm on Twitter at OxleyIO, OXLEYIO. And I have open DMs on there. I'm happy to answer questions or if people send me stuff.
You don't want to give out your email address on a podcast?
I don't know.
All right. And then if you could do anything in the world, have anything in the world, what is your wildest dream?
It's not going to be completely unique to me, but lifelong dream ever since I was a kid would be to go to other planets, like go check out Mars, be one of the first people there traipsing around, not having an easy life, but at the same time, kind of blazing new trails for humanity and all that good stuff.
Love it. Love it. That's a new one and super cool.
Out of this world.
Yes. Awesome. All right. Well, David, thank you so much. I think you gave us all a lot to think about. We had tons of cool stuff in this episode. If you guys got value out of it, please share. This is something that your friends and family should know about. They should be changing their passwords. They should be doing all these things, including us. And I'm really hoping that I'm psyching myself up right now to go check off these five things that we need to do. All right. Thanks, David.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Go to our website, firedrillpodcast.com, to continue the discussion and get the link to our private Facebook group.
If you like us, leave us a review on iTunes. If you're like me, you have no idea how to do that. So, in the podcast app or in iTunes, search for Fire Drill Podcast, find it, click the Reviews tab, and write something to make my mother proud of me. We read every single review and want to say thank you from the bottom of our hearts for making this podcast possible.